Bashus, Rabbi Davis, Bashus, Rosh Kolo, Rabbi Parnas, I don't think I'm worthy of those exceedingly kind words. I'm grateful for them nonetheless. Bashus, the Chavrei Kolo, in particular, my dear friend Rabbi Stoll, this is absolutely incredible. What a night. What an accomplishment. I can say, as perhaps the only outsider in the room was watching, and watching with nothing but envy. This is such an achievement for a community. And how appropriate, on the eve of Shavuos, as we're about to together stand around Har Sinai and collectively in a unified fashion receive the greatest treasure, the greatest gift, Hashem's Torah. Tonight, you are a beacon of light, not only throughout South Florida, but throughout the world. You are an example. And I can only hope that for our community in Boca Raton, that Kinas Sofrim will be Tar B'Chochma, that seeing and looking tonight, I've been texting our staff all night, giving them the update, telling them we need to emulate to whatever degree that we can. So Yasher Koach, absolutely incredible. Our parasha that begins the fourth book of the Torah, Bamidbar, includes the census, the counting of the Jewish people. And we know famously that Shevet Levi, the tribe of Levi, are counted separately. They're not included. They had not sinned. They had not violated this egregious miscalculation. And therefore, they're counted all alone. But Shevet Levi have a distinction. They are designated with a unique mission and their purpose, unlike any other tribe. They're not destined to inherit land with everyone else. They are allocated cities within the lands of the other tribes, because Shevet Levi are the original model of the community Kolo. They sit, they learn, they teach, they live, they are an example for those around them. So they can't be isolated or segregated on their own. They're integrated in the community, and that's how they have that impact. The Rambam writes that until today, it's not only those who genetically descend from the tribe of Levi who play that role, but it's any. It's the Yechidei Skula, it's the fortunate, devoted, selfless, dedicated ones who want to serve that role of both sitting and learning and of teaching, who have that status, who qualify as Shevet Levi. And this wonderful Kolo that clearly has such an impact on the Hollywood community, in collaboration with this incredible shul and the community at large of the Shevet Levi in our time, should continue to have bracha and hatzlacha, to have such a hashpah, such an impact and influence to elevate, to transform, and to expose everyone to the beauty of Torah, the transformational impact of Torah, to elevate all who learn and all who support, men, women, and children who see the primacy of Torah in your lives. A woman once attended one of my classes. She was a balash tshuva. And she said to me, Rabbi, I want to tell you an incredible story. She said, you know, when I was a kid, I came out of public school one day. My mother used to pick me up in the car. When I came out of the front door and down the steps, it was raining outside. And I got into the car, and I said to my mother, and my mother said to me, I bet I can guess which of your classmates are Jewish. So the woman described to me, she looked at her mother and said, how in the world would you know? Based on their last names, you don't even know their last names. How do you know who's Jewish? So the mother said, that one's Jewish, that one's Jewish, that one's Jewish. She said, Ma, how did you know? She said, it's very simple. It's raining outside. Those who took their books and held it over their head to protect their head at the expense of the book, those aren't from Jewish families. And those who took the book and put it under their jacket, under their shirt, tucked it away, allowing themselves to get drenched, but protecting and preserving the book, those are the children from Jewish homes. We have always been, since our inception, we are the people of the book. Ki hem chayenu v'orech yameinu. Torah is not a hobby, it's not a habit, it's not a vocation, it's not something we do on the side, it doesn't complement our life. It's the very air that we breathe. It informs, it inspires, it guides. It gives us our sustenance, our very life, our energy. It animates our entire being. And without it, be lost. Without it, we would wilt, we would dry up. Without it, we would be desperate. Tonight is a celebration, a remarkable celebration of extraordinary achievements in Torah. When I read and I heard how many people, 120 people making siyumim, how many, 6,000 pages of Gemara learned? These are astounding numbers. Those are incredible numbers for the 10th or 25th anniversary of that project. But for the first year, it's something incredible. But what I want to share with you in my limited time are a few thoughts on why learn Torah. Why? Why not just get to the bottom line? Tell me what to do. Of course, we believe in living halachic lives, Jewishly rich lives. But why do I need to learn Torah? I have a lot on my plate. We have a lot to do. We have so many distractions and obligations and burdens throughout the day. To find that time early in the morning, to carve out in the middle of the day, or when we're exhausted, to take the last ounces of energy to learn at night. Why? Why does it matter? And why is it so important? And why does it matter that every one of us participate and find our chelek in Torah? So I want to share with you very quickly, five reasons, five benefits, five goals, five themes as to why Torah is so critical to our lives. Reason number one, there's a rare psychological disorder. It only affects less than 1% of the population, technically or scientifically. It's called multiple personality disorder. And while the technical diagnosis, of which I don't mean to minimize at all, only affects a small portion of the population, if we're honest, it seems to affect almost all of us. We have competing parts of our personality. There's the me with this group of friends, there's the me with that group of friends, there's the me at work, there's the me at home, there's the me in shul, there's the me here, there's the me on vacation, there are so many components. We're multifaceted, and different people and different environments draw out different components of who we are. Every one of us has a struggle within us. Which voice, which element of our personality, which value system, which set of priorities will reign supreme, will supersede or reign sovereign over the other? In fact, the word persona, which is the root of the word personality, in its original Latin, means mask. In Shakespearean plays, the actors would don their persona. They would put on their mask for the performance. And we have personas or personalities that we wear to different places in our life. Torah has the incredible ability to unify the fragmented, divided parts of who we are. To not live competing lives, and to not live divided lives or inconsistent lives, to not lead duplicitous lives, but to find that unifying sense of identity of who we are. I'll tell you an incredible kliyakar very quickly, that when Rivka, we all know, walks by a base of Arazar, she feels kicking. When she walks by a base medra, she feels kicking. She's so disturbed, she shows bother, Vatelech Adroshus Hashem, she goes to consult and find out what's going on. And she learns, don't worry. Shnei goyim bebidnech. You have two nations, you have twins. Don't worry. And she leaves appeased. She seems satisfied by the explanation, and the Kliyakar wonders why. One of those children is kicking to get out when she passes the Beis Avodah Zarah. Why is it at all comforting for her to know, don't worry, there's twins, there's two nations within your womb? And the Kliyakar explains that for Rivka, the worst thought was that she was pregnant with one child, and the child had a split personality. The child couldn't stay true to anything. The child simply would mold and conform to whichever building they passed on that block. For a parent, that was a startling thought. That was a tremendous fear. And when she learns, true, one of the children wants to get out of a Beis Avodah Zarah, you're going to have to work on that. It's going to take a lot of parenting. But to at least know that each of the children is dedicated and devoted is united and unified in their personality, is not duplicitous with a split personality. So the first reason I want to suggest why we learn Torah and it's so critical as our very life source is that Torah is the incredible ability to unify our personalities into one coherent, cohesive identity. Torah learning is not some academic exercise. Learning Torah is not external to who we are, but it transforms us from people learning Torah to Torah personalities. Those who participated in the Siyum tonight will, I'm sure, agree that maybe it began with being an individual who led a certain lifestyle and then you found the time to learn Torah. But by the time you finished your perek or your mesechta or the dafim you learned, you weren't just the same person who now took on a project of learning Torah. You became a member of the Torah community, a Torah personality. It influences and changes everything of how we speak and what we look at and how we interact, what we think, our values. Torah unifies and it transforms us. The Brisa in the sixth parak of Pirkei Avos says, in the name of Reb Meir, Kol Ha'Osek B'Torah L'Shma Zoch L'Dvarim Harbe, a person who studies Torah sincerely, authentically, merits incredible blessings. And on that list, one of the things, says the Brisa, is Torah Machsharta Lios Tzadik. Torah is machshir us to be righteous. It's a funny word. Torah Machsharto. What's the root of that word? It's machshir us. So, Rav Chaim Voloshiner in his Ruach HaChaim, his commentary on Pirkei Avos says, just look at the root of the word. The root of the word machsharto is kosher. When you kosher something, you have a pot. You have a pan, you have a utensil, it's absorbed a non-kosher taste. You expose it to the flame, to heat, or to hot water, and it purges that foreign, contaminated taste and restores the pot to its pristine state. Torah machsharto lios tzadik. You know, we have all kinds of contaminations. We absorb all kinds of messages and images and values and ideas, temptations and desires. Just by being alive today, maybe in our generation more than any, just drove down from Boca. You pass billboards. You have to go to the mikveh after you see them. Torah machsharto. Torah has the capacity that whatever image, whatever idea, whatever influence that contaminates our brain, Torah machsharto liyosah. You want to purge the image. You want to restore our kli, our brain and our heart to their pristine state is through the means and through the mechanism of Torah. Gemara Pesachim Samaches tells us that Rav Yosef, Biyoma Da'atzarta, Rav Yosef on Shavuos, Amar Avdi Li'Egla Tulsa, prepare for me, at least according to Rashi, the third born calf. It was a delicacy, delicious, like our meal tonight. Omar, he said, Ilo Hayoma De'Kagorim, because if not for Shavuos, and the gift of Torah, Kama Yosef Ika Bashuka. Rashi says, what does it mean, Kama Yosef Ika Bashuka? Hare Anashim Harbe Bashuk, Sheshmam Yosef, Oma Be'ila Be'nam. I would just be an average Joe. I'd just be another Joe in the street, another Joe in the marketplace, if not for Torah and its impact on me. But the Baalei Mussar say, no, that's not what it means. But rather, what Rav Yosef was saying is, if not for Atzeres, if not for Shavuos, if not for the gift of Torah, Kama Yosef Ika Bashuka, how many Yosefs would I be in the shuk? There'd be this aspect of my personality, that aspect, the guy at work, the guy at home, the guy at minyan, the guy on the way out. There'd be so many components to who I am, I'd feel so fragmented and divided. I would feel so confused. Thank God for Torah, which unifies me and creates a consistency to my life and to my lifestyle and to who I am. Torah machsharto. Torah unifies. We don't have to adapt or conform or change like a chameleon depending where we are. Torah allows us to be true to who we are, allows us to be true to ourselves and true to our mission. To go from people who happen to learn Torah. You know, if you play tennis or racquetball, if you have a hobby, whatever, you collect stamps, if you, whatever it is, you're a person who also does that. But when you learn Torah, you're not just a person who learns Torah, you become a Ben Torah, a family of B'nai Torah. Torah transforms us. Number two, we say every day in Shema, the Ahavtas Hashem Elokecha, the obligation to love God. The Rambam and everyone's bothered, how can you be commanded in emotion? How can we be told, feel this, right now, feel this? Can't necessarily regulate our emotions. You can tell me what to do. Blow the shofar, take the lulav and aser, light the candle, put on the tefillin, don't eat this, eat that. How could you tell us how to feel? Everyone's bothered by it. And the Rambam in Hilchos Yesod HaTorah gives his answer. And says the Rambam, the mitzvah of Ahavas Hashem, the obligation to love God, is not an emotional commandment at all. It is a commandment to know God. Yediyas Hashem. Get to know God, and you can't help but love God. To know God is to love God. God is the essence, the source of all goodness. God is the source of everything in the world. Whatever you value, whatever you admire, whatever you care about, the Ribono Shel Olam is the source of it. And the more you come to know God, the more you can't help but fall more and more in love. And you are filled with a taifa gedola, says the Rambam, this overwhelming desire to know HaKadosh Baruch Hu even more. And the Rambam says, how do you get to know God? All of Yahadus, all of Judaism, everything that we've done from when we woke up this morning till we'll go to sleep tonight, it's all about being invested in a relationship with Hashem. We sometimes make the terrible mistake of emphasizing the do's and the don'ts and the minutiae and the actions and becoming obsessive, compulsive, and neurotic. But the halacha, which is all non-negotiable and critically important, is all there to create a platform and reinforce a sense, I'm in a relationship with Hashem. He loves me, and I love Him. I talk to Him, and He talks to me. We communicate with one another. We're in a relationship. How can you be in a relationship with someone you don't know? So says the Rambam, how do you get to know God? Two ways. Number one, you get to know the Ribono Shel Olam from His world. See His world. The famous story of Shamshon HaFal Hirsh, the Swiss Alps. Hashem will ask, no, what do you think of my Alps? See the world, study chemistry, biology, physics. This is the Rambam. Understand how the world works, and you'll see a blueprint of Hashem. But there's a more direct way. Imagine you had a great-grandparent you never had the privilege to know, a grandparent, and you were able to see their artwork, their handiwork. You get to know them. But then you discover their diary. You have access to their word. You truly connect in an intimate fashion. Says the Rambam, we know Hashem through His world. But we know Hashem best through His diary. Torah is His diary. When we daven, we're talking to Hashem. And when we learn Torah, Hashem is talking to us. He's telling us about His values, what He cares about. And that's reason number two. Number three. You probably never heard of something called the mosquito ring. You can Google it later, after the speech. Mosquito tone, mosquito ring, is a sine wave that some teenagers use on their cell phone. They did a few years ago, I don't know if they're still doing it, to alert one another when they're texting or trying to make contact in a way their teacher can't hear. And why can't the teachers hear? Because studies show that most of us can't hear much above a 13 to 14 kilohertz range. But the younger you are and the sharper your hearing, the higher the tone that you can continue to hear. So teenagers were using this tone in order to be able to communicate with one another in a way that adults would never know. I actually heard about this a number of years ago and I looked it up and I played it on my computer. I said, I can't hear anything. And then my kids came running in the room with their hands over their ears. Turn that off! Can't hear. There was an inventor who had a store in a mall where the kids were lingering and they were bothering the store and he couldn't get rid of them. So he created what he called the mosquito sound, the mosquito tone, which he plays consistently and it keeps people below a certain age away because they can't stand the sound. It's a repellent. Adults can't hear it, teenagers can't stand it. Why am I telling you this? Because the pasuk describes the experience of Matan Torah. Sadvarim ha'ilah diber Hashem al kol kalachem bahar mitocha esha anan v'harafel. These words God spoke to us in a congregation from the fire and the cloud. Kol gadol v'lo yasaf. Moshe describes, it was a great sound, v'lo yasaf. And God wrote them, carved them on the stones and gave them to me. What do these words mean? V'lo yasaf. Kol gadol, the great voice of the Almighty, His sacred Torah. But what is v'lo yasaf? So the Ibn Ezra, the Rashbam, and others say, v'lo yasaf means never to be repeated again. This was unprecedented, it's unparalleled, it's unrepeated. It would never, ever happen again. The Ribbono Shel Olam would address us directly. Kol gadol v'lo yasaf, this was a one-time moment, a transcendent moment in history, never to be replicated. But Unklus, Targum Unklus, translates v'lo yasaf not as never repeated, but rather as v'lo psak, that God's voice began and never stopped. It never ceased. The Ramban agrees with Unklus, and the Ramban brings some sukkim as evidence that the Shoresh Yud Samach Fei can mean never stops. So it's a machlokas. Ibn Ezra, the Rashbam, Kol Gadol V'lo Yasaf, God spoke at our Sinai, V'lo Yasaf, one time only, never to be replicated. Unklus and Ramban say, no, V'lo Yasaf means it never stopped. God began to speak, and His voice continues to resound and resonate ever since. So who's right? What's the pshat? The Ibn Ezra, the Rashbam, or Unklus and the Ramban? And like the mosquito repellent tone, I think the answer is up to us. When we dedicate ourselves to learn Torah, when we're listening to His messages, when we're imbibing the spiritual air and nourishment of Torah, then Kol Gadol V'lo Yasaf means that the Ribbono Shel Olam's voice continues to echo in our ears. It continues to reverberate in our lives. Those who haven't opened a Gemara since high school or earlier, those who never opened a Sefer, those who feel that they've graduated to a stage of life where the learning is for others, then Kol Gadol V'lo Yasaf meant it was never repeated. It happened. It's part of the past. Which pshat is correct is up to us and the attitude we bring. If we want God's voice to continue to reverberate in our ears, then we have to tune in, extend our antenna, and listen carefully. Number four, I'm winding down. What defines a good person? What's the measure if a person is ethical and moral? We're living particularly in a time of moral relativism, of humanism. Everyone gets to decide what's moral, what's ethical, what's correct, personal autonomy, what I like, what makes me happy, as long as it doesn't hurt another. And we can debate the definition of hurting another. But we're living in a time of Isha Yashar Be'enav. Everyone does as they see fit. But we as Jewish people don't believe that. We believe that there is an authoritative right and wrong. Excuse me. That there is a moral correct. It's an absolute morality. It's not a relative morality. So how do we know? How do we know? It's okay, thanks. Two people have a business dispute. Two people have a question about life. How do we know what's ethical, what's honest, what's correct? Do we just go by our gut? How we feel? What makes sense? What's logical? How do we know? Chazon Ish has a wonderful sefer, Emunah Bitachon, that's famous for the first essay that talks about those two terms, Emunah and Bitachon. But the incredible sefer has many other chapters, and one of them addresses exactly this question. How do you know what's moral and ethical? How do we tap into absolute morality? And he explains, that's what Torah learning are all about. When you plow through Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, is learning the Daf, Baba Basra, when you're learning about transactions and acquisitions and loans, damages, resolving disputes, when you learn Torah Shebaal Peh, when we tap into the sacred tradition of Torah, we are accessing a world of absolute truth. Aye, there's diametrically opposed opinions. Not for now. But within the Gemara is a world of absolute truth. So that we're trying to understand God's vision for His world, for our world. Not just to follow someone's instinct, inclination, their logic, what feels right. but the absolute truth of what's right. And lastly, and I would argue maybe most importantly for tonight, book clubs are very popular. People reading the same book and then getting together, people following others' book lists so they can be in the same, reading the same books as the followers of that personality. Why do people participate in a book club? Because they don't just want to understand the book from their perspective. They want to become part of a community of people who are reading the same thing, who are on the same page, who are drawing the same lessons. When one learns Torah, aside from Torah's capacity to unify our personality, and aside from it giving us the ability to continue to hear Hashem's message, and aside from Torah enabling us to be a good person, but it creates a community of Torah learners. It creates a community who are steeped in the same values. We transcend time and space. When you're looking at that Daf Gemara, you're on the same page as your great-great-great-great-grandfather. On the same page as your great-great-great-great-grandson. Living in a world changing at such a rapid pace. Almost nothing else about our lives is the same as our ancestors, or is the same as will be for our progeny and descendants. What creates that connection? What creates that community that transcends time, that transcends space, is being part of a Torah community. Rabbi Soloveitchik once described that he remembered as a young child, as a very young boy at home, his father would give shiur of Moshe Soloveitchik in the family home, and he remembers hearing the shiur, and his father would quote the Rambam and pose a question on the Rambam and defend the Rambam. And the Rav described the feeling of fear when the challenge was issued to the Rambam. What if his father couldn't defend him, couldn't get him off the hook, and describes this vibrant, living sense of Torah. And at the end of this description, he writes, it's in Uvikashta Misham, slowly I would go to mother and tell her with a broken heart, "Mother, father can't resolve the Rambam, what should we do?" "Don't be sad," mother would answer. "Father will find a solution for the Rambam. And if he doesn't find one, maybe when you grow up, you'll resolve his words. The main thing is to learn Torah with joy and with excitement." Rabbi Soloveitchik went on to say, "This experience belongs to my childhood. Still, it's not the golden fantasy of a little boy. The feeling in it is not mystical. It's a completely historical, psychological reality that's alive even now in the depths of my soul. When I sit down to learn Torah, I find myself immediately in the company of the sages of the Masorah. The relations between us are personal. The Rambam's on my right, Rabbeinu Tam on my left, Rashi up front. He interprets, Rabbeinu Tam disputes him, the Rambam issues a ruling, the Ravid objects. They're all in my little room, sitting around my table. They look at me affectionately, enjoy arguing and studying, encourage and support the way a father does. Torah study is not solely an educational activity. It's not merely formal technical matter embodied in the discovery and exchange of facts. It's a powerful experience of becoming friends with many generations of Torah scholars, joining of one spirit with another, the union of souls. Those who transmitted the Torah and those who receive it come together in one historical way station." I was at a small rabbinic conference last week. Rabbi Davis was there, and Rav Schechter, my Rebbe Rosh Yeshiva YU, was there. And an earlier session of the day, there was a conversation among the rabbis about the concept of rabbinic loneliness. Sometimes your day can be filled with tragedy and sadness and joy and simchas and the ups and downs, and you can feel no one can possibly understand the... I'm sure every profession feels this, but you get to talk about it when you get together. That's what rabbis talk about when we get together. So the rabbis were talking about their sense of rabbinic loneliness. So when we were with Rav Schechter that evening, the question was posed to him, "Rebbe, does Rebbe ever feel lonely? Is it ever challenging to be able to feel driven in your mission when you can sometimes be attacked from different sides and so on? Does Rebbe ever feel lonely?" And he looked at us quizzically with a puzzled look on his face and he said, "I'm not exaggerating an iota." He said, "Why would I feel lonely? I have the Tanaim and the Amoraim and the Rishonim and the Achronim. I'm surrounded by people. Why in the world would I ever feel lonely?" And he didn't say that to impress anyone. He couldn't understand how anyone could not feel that way. similar to what Rabbi Soloveitchik described. And so tonight is the celebration of all five of these reasons to learn Torah. But most of all, tonight is the celebration, as Rabbi Stoll said, about a community of Torah learners. Not just the Hollywood community, and not just the South Florida community, and not just the community of the 21st century, but connecting with a community of Torah learners since the Torah was given at Har Sinai so many years ago next week. It helps us transcend time and space and tap into the rich legacy, which is our Torah. I want to end by telling you a story. You may be familiar with it. I am ending. I'm at the end of my allotted time. The very end. It's a story Rabbi Krohn is fond of saying. You may be familiar with it, but it's worth repeating because it touches me every time I hear it or say it. Camp in upstate New York, Camp Morris, and there was an older guy who kept showing up in the camp base medrash and learning. He's in the back of the base medrash, clearly older, not a camper, not a staff member, and yet he just kept showing up in the camp base medrash. Rabbi Plutchuk, one of the teachers, the Rebbeim in the camp, went over to the guy and introduced himself, welcomed him to the camp, into the base medrash, and essentially, after getting past the small talk, said, "What are you doing here? What brings you here?" And the man explained that he didn't have a formal Jewish education, and he didn't have the opportunity growing up to really learn Gemara, to tap into the richness of Torah. And the man said that he was recently diagnosed with liver cancer. And he was depressed and despondent, and what gave him hope, what took up his time and gave him energy, was the discovery of Art Scroll Gemaras. The Art Scroll Gemara gave him access to a world that he would previously deny. And he would open the Masechta, he'd open a Gemara, and that gave him chiyas, it gave him life. And so that summer, he's in upstate New York, he knows there's a base medrash of young people, and so he came to learn each and every day. And the rabbi was so impressed, they struck up a friendship. The last day of camp, the man was in the back of the base medrash, not his usual seat, and he looked awful. He looked really down. So the rabbi went over to him and asked him, "What's the matter? You're always so cheerful, upbeat, positive. Why are you sitting in the back of the base medrash? Why do you look so sad?" And the man said, "Listen, my illness is progressing. I don't likely have long to live. And I'm starting to feel, with my Art Scroll Gemara compared to these kids who are a fraction of my age, that I'm barely able to learn anything. What am I accomplishing? What's the point? I can't compete. Why bother? What difference does my breaking my teeth on the English and the Art Scroll really make? What's the point? Is this really how I want to spend my limited time left?" That moment, the rabbi remembered something they had recently read, and he had siyata deshmaya, incredible divine inspiration, to recall the story he had read and tell it to this elderly man. There was an Italian conductor, Arturo Toscanini, the most acclaimed musician, one of the most acclaimed of the 20th century. And Arturo Toscanini had a biographer who wanted to interview him, write his biography, tell his story, capture his life. So Toscanini said, "Tomorrow night I'm listening to a concert that I used to be the conductor of. I'm not well enough to go in person, but over the phone I'm going to be listening to the symphony." So the biographer thought, "This is a perfect opportunity. Can I come and watch you, listen, and listen with you?" Toscanini said, "Absolutely not. You're going to distract me. I'm not interested. I have to be alone and concentrate." But the biographer nudged him, like Rabbi Stoll, and Toscanini finally gave in. That's the half deal. Toscanini finally gave in and allowed him to sit there and to watch. Toscanini called into the symphony. He listened intently, watched, took notes, he absorbed it. And when it was over, the biographer said to the great conductor, "Wow, that was incredible. Wasn't that magnificent?" Toscanini looked at him and said, "No." "So what do you mean, no? That was outstanding." Toscanini said, "No. That piece was meant to be played by 120 musicians, 15 of them violinists, but there were only 14 violinists." So the biographer said, "Come on, what a bug guy. Who is he trying to impress me? As if over the phone you could tell the difference." He didn't challenge Toscanini, but the next day he called the director of the symphony of the night before and said, "You know, great performance last night. Tell me, how many musicians participated. How many musicians played? The director said, you know, it's funny you ask. It's meant to be played by 120, 15 of them violinists, but one of the violinists got sick last minute and didn't show up, so we only had 14. The biographer was blown away and went back to Arturo Toscanini and said, how could you possibly know? Listening over the telephone? How could you know? So Toscanini said to him, you know, there's an enormous difference between me and you. You're in the audience. You listen to the overall symphony, and it sounds great. But I'm the conductor. I hear every note from every instrument. And when one of those instruments is missing, it spoils the entire piece for me. That's all I hear. The missing violinist may not matter to you, but it matters to me, the conductor. And the rabbi turned to that elderly man in the back of the Beis Medrash and he said, you may not think that your learning from the English at an art school makes a difference. You may not think it matters. But to Hashem, it makes a difference. We're all musicians in the Ribono Shel Olam symphony. We all play our own instruments and we all make our own music. And when one of us is missing, maybe the other musicians can't tell, but it matters to the conductor. And so all of you who participate in the Siyum tonight, I want to wish you a Yasher Koach for your role in the symphony. And for those who've not yet tasted the sweetness of Torah learning, pick up your instrument. Play and find your music. Because whatever level you're on, or wherever your starting point, or however little time you think you have, you think it may not matter to others. But I promise you, it matters to the conductor. Thank you.